Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of our lungs on www.kboo.fm. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, even as public officials scramble to come up with band-aid solutions they hope will resolve the uprising across the country, and given the spread of it around the world, we look at what might be some of the underlying issues on the minds of protesters in addition to police abuse and murder. For young people who are facing the challenge of destruction of the environment, and for all of us who are facing that challenge, we discuss the use of chemicals in U.S. agriculture. That is for our weekly Earth Watch. And our guest is Rob Fox, Communications Associate in Iowa for the Pesticide Action Network. Rob is also a farmer. And we also look at U.S. spending, what is not being spent on domestic policy to help end poverty, for example, but money being put into regime change and destabilization around the world. We take a look at U.S.-backed efforts against Evo Morales, who was the first indigenous president of Bolivia. Our guest is Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. And this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Thank you so much for staying with us. What I'd like to do now, before we go to our first segment, I just want to go to a clip from that PRA collection. I've been playing a lot of Malcolm X. I'm getting requests from young people to play Malcolm X. And let us go now to that clip.
And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican nor an American. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. When When we open our eyes today and look around America, we see America not through the eyes of someone who has enjoyed the fruits of Americanism. We see America through the eyes of someone who has been the victim of Americanism. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. We haven't benefited from America's democracy. We've only suffered from America's hypocrisy. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. If you're black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. Long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're South. Don't call Governor Wallace a Dixie governor. Romney is a Dixie governor. $22 million black victims of Americanism are waking up, and they're gaining a new political consciousness, becoming politically mature. And as they develop this political maturity, they're able to see the recent trends in these political elections. They see that the whites are so evenly divided that every time they vote, the race is so close they have to go back and count the votes all over again. And which means that any block, any minority that has a block of votes that stick together is in a strategic position. Either way you go, that's who gets it. You're in a position to determine who go to the White House and who stay in the doghouse. You're the one who has that power. You can keep Johnson in Washington, D.C., or you can send him back to his Texas cotton patch. You're the one who sent Kennedy to Washington. You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they've brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump.
Okay, just the strident voice there of Malcolm X, but it does remind us about the importance of voting, a critical election coming up, and all of the voter suppression efforts that's going on most recently in Georgia, where people had to wait online 8 hours. I heard somebody waited online even longer than that to vote in the state of Georgia. I quickly now want to go on to talk about what is happening now and what has happened in Bolivia. You know, a lot of people are in the political class. They are assuming that the uprising, people are on the streets only about racism, only about police murder, only about police brutality. But if you talk to protesters on the street, they're telling you they want a total change of priorities in this country. You know, there's the environmental crisis that's going on, the U.S. spending all this money running around the world, starting wars, destabilizing governments, regime change. All of this is really part and parcel of the program. So we really have to think broadly in that way. And of course, the critical issues right now around police killings of black people. And people in other parts of the world are also saying to us, you know, as you're out there protesting against violence and racism and police brutality, remember those of us in other parts of the world starting with the Global South. And today we're going to do exactly that, focusing on Bolivia. On November 10th, 2019, democratically elected Bolivian President Evo Morales was forced to step down after the U.S.-backed opposition claimed that he rigged the country's general election that was held on October 20th, 2019. Now, Evo Morales, you might recall, Bolivia's first indigenous and socialist president, was forced out of power in what many have described as a coup. During Bolivia's last election in October, Evo Morales won 47.8% of the vote, compared with the 36.51% received by the challenger Carlos Mesa, his right-wing opposition rival. Now, this was enough for Evo to be the winner without a runoff second round vote. But with Washington, D.C.'s backing, the opposition began violent protests the following day, rounding up and beating up indigenous Evo Morales supporters on the street, and Patricia Arce, an indigenous woman who served as mayor of Vinto for Evo Morales' movement toward socialism party, was dragged down the street by her hair, drenched in white paint, and some Evo supporters were even murdered. They were killed. Shortly afterwards, the Organization of American States, known as the OAS, and long known to be the arm of the United States to keep Central and Latin America and the Caribbean in line, the OAS conducted an audit of the election in which it claimed that it found clear manipulation and significant irregularities overseen by the Electoral Commission. But what really happened? What's going on? Well, let us welcome Jake Johnson, Senior Research Associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And Jake is a journalist, writing for the New York Times, The Intercept, Boston Review, Vice News, Truthout, and others. He's done extensive research on this on behalf of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. So, Jake, welcome as you break all of this down for us. Jake Johnston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Jake, what's the story? You have an election. It looks as though Evo Morales has won, and there shouldn't be a second runoff. And here comes the OAS. Tell us about the OAS role.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so this, you know, again, you had the election on October 20th, and that evening the preliminary vote count was suspended. And at that point in time, Evo's lead was just under the 10 percentage point threshold to avoid the second round. Now, the next day, when the system continued processing results and an update was provided, Evo had secured this 10 percentage point lead, enough to win in the first round. And that's when the OAS role really becomes key. So that evening, on October 21st, the OAS put out a press release decrying a drastic and inexplicable change in the trend of the vote that undermined the credibility. And now this is a statement, right, one day after the election. And now it took us about 24 hours to look at the data ourselves and realize that the OAS had no basis for this statement. And so, again, I mean, everything that's happened that you described so well, but what's new this week is that researchers in the New York Times obtained the actual data that the OAS had for their analysis and proved categorically, this is, you know, again, many of us said this at the time, but it's now sort of beyond a doubt, that the OAS had no basis for that claim whatsoever. But that claim, that initial claim on October 21st, was latched onto by Bolivia's opposition, who cited it as proof that fraud had taken place and really consolidated this narrative of fraud and emboldened the opposition, which eventually, as you mentioned, led to the coup d'etat on November 10th.
You know, since then, you have a far right-wing government headed by this Jeanine Añez, and she openly, nearly 8 months after Evo Morales was posted it, you know, on, as we have just been discussing, on these unsubstantiated allegations. The mainstream media outlets, they're now finally beginning to admit the OAS role. The New York Times has released a new report in which it claims, it states that claims of fraud in the general election relied on incorrect data and inappropriate statistical techniques. They don't mention, though, Jake, the work that you all have done. And, you know, this Luis Almagro Almagro, who is the head of the OAS. He's a U.S. guy, and he's been very, very problematic also in terms of his role in Haiti, propping up that brutal U.S.-backed government there. So, you know, just tell us a bit more about that, I mean, in terms of how the mainstream media is handling it, and what they're leaving out, and also what do you think needs to happen now?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, it's an excellent point, right? I mean, this was, you know, again, abundantly clear to those of us who were paying close attention at the time. You know, I can say personally, I when I realized that the OAS, you know, had no basis for the statement, I reached out to a high-level official inside the OAS, told them that their data was incorrect, and the response wasn't to push back. In fact, the response was, we know. So this wasn't a mistake, right? This was a conscious decision to lie about an event in Bolivia that has had extremely devastating consequences for Bolivia and for the region. And I think it's important to note, too, that there remains today, 8 months after the fact, dozens and dozens of people in jail based upon electoral fraud allegations solely from the OAS, right? So this is not just, you know, a mistake. It's not just something we can go back and say, oh, we got it wrong. There are real profound human consequences of these actions, right? And the question becomes, how then can you hold these institutions accountable? And I think, you know, the point you make about Luis Almagro and his role in Haiti, right? This is not just about Bolivia. This is about an institution that is involved in countries throughout the region. And its lack of credibility, its lack of neutrality, its overt intervention in these political processes is damaging for the entire region, not just for Bolivia and not just for Haiti. Right? So this is a much broader issue. I think what's key when you're thinking about Almagro, too, is the way he has cozied up to the far right in the United States, right? And especially Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida. And so we've seen this sort of, you know, alliance between the OAS and these Latin America hawks in the U.S. that have really pushed the organization, and as you mentioned, it's always sort of had this roots, but really into a more sort of overtly far-right reactionary way in the last couple of years. And if you think about this just in relation to Bolivia, so Marco Rubio actually tweeted on the morning of October 21st, the day after the election, that there was, you know, he was concerned that Evo was going to manipulate the vote. 12 hours later is when the OAS put out that press release alleging that the vote had been manipulated. Now, what we've learned through later reporting in the LA Times is that a far-right Rubio acolyte, Carlos Trujillo, who was the U.S. representative to the OAS, had actually steered the OAS observation mission to find fraud, right? Now, you put this all together, and it seems very clear, but what's been sorely lacking is any sort of actual reporting from the mainstream media about what actually happened. Why did that press release get released? Who was involved with it? And connecting that with what the situation is on the ground today in Bolivia.
Bolivia, of course, you know, rich in a lot of resources, including what's referred to as white gold, the lithium reserves, really essential for electric cars, cell phones, and other major electronic devices. So everybody, all of us who are part of the environmental movement and looking for alternatives to fossil fuels, we also have to keep in mind the exploitation and repression that can happen in countries like Bolivia, in some ways really going after that kind of wealth. But Jake Johnston, I mean, this image of the Fernando Camacho, a Christian fascist, really, who was one of the coup leaders, far-right multi-millionaire, right, who rose from fascist movements in the Santa Cruz region, where the U.S. encouraged separatism. He went with a Bible in one hand and a national flag in the other, bowing his head in prayer above the presidential seal and, you know, fulfilling his vow to purge Bolivia of indigenous heritage from the government and, quote unquote, return God to the burned palace. And then that Pachamama will never return to the palace, of course, knowing, you know, the indigenous spiritual beliefs there. And, you know, Jake, the environmental movement globally also has to look at what happened in Bolivia, because Evo Morales were such forward thinkers on this and actually had coined the term the rights of Mother Earth, and this then was integrated into a UN document. So they, in orchestrating this coup, you're absolutely right in terms of trying to destabilize the entire region, but also trying to get rid of this idea of that the earth itself has rights. And Bolivia and Evo Morales was very much at the forefront of this, as are indigenous people around the world. Jake Johnson.
Yeah, and I think you can't overlook the overtly racist motivations behind the coup and behind what's happened after, right? Jeanine Añez, the de facto president today, right? The long history of these racist and anti-indigenous comments referring to indigenous Bolivians as savages, you know, proclaiming the Bible back in the palace, like you mentioned with Camacho. And, you know, you see, again, this is, you know, and I think it was such a great introduction that you gave to this program, sort of linking what's happening in the United States and elsewhere with the sort of foreign policy, right? And we see through U.S. foreign policy the way we export these institutions and these, you know, racist policies to the rest of the world, right? And so the response after this coup, you know, the massive protests in response to it, and the Bolivian military with this sort of overtly anti-indigenous administration massacred civilians, right? Largely indigenous protesters who were shot in cold blood in protesting this coup. And, you know, the U.S. didn't raise a peep. The OAS, of course, has not raised this as a concern, you know. And so you see how this sort of perpetuates these systems, right, through the U.S. foreign policy system and through our intervention in foreign countries. And again, as you sort of put this, right, sort of extends these systems across the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. And under Evo Morales, his government drastically cut deforestation by 64% between 2010 and 2013. Bolivia has the greatest number of trees per inhabitant in South America. I mean, you're right, the implications are very wide, but we're running a little short of time. And about this Luis Almagro, I know that there was a move supported by some of the CARICOM countries and others to get him out as head of OAS. And clearly that didn't happen. I mean, the U.S., I imagine, put a lot of pressure. They tried to split CARICOM and get the votes they needed to get him back in place. But this is really bad news. I mean, how long is this guy going to be around? And you know, we'll see if the other countries in the region, not the United States, can mobilize itself to make sure that there isn't such a U.S.-controlled hawk heading the OAS. Just your final thoughts, Jake Johnston.
Yeah, this is an extremely important point. I think it very much ties into what happened in Bolivia, and that Almagro was actually seeking his own re-election to be Secretary General of the OAS at the time, right? And by ousting Morales, he removed a likely no vote, and the de facto coup regime was a very vocal supporter, unsurprisingly, of Almagro. And it also sent a message to the right-wing governments in the region, right, who had actually been somewhat skeptical of Almagro, not sure if he was even taking a hard enough line for their liking. And this really sent a message that, you know, they could trust him, that he was their guy. And in fact, he was reelected, as you mentioned. You know, the efforts by some countries to sort of prevent his reelection was thwarted. He was reelected to a five-year term earlier this year. But I think, you know, with the increasing attention on these grotesque flaws from the OAS and the human impact of these lies from the OAS, you know, I think it's critical that there becomes a movement to demand Almagro's resignation. It's really the only thing at this point that can alter the course of what the OAS has been doing in the hemisphere.
Yeah, and we'll see how all of that goes. We're going to continue to follow it. We do quite a lot of coverage in the region, and have several of your team from the Center for Economic and Policy Research on our show. So please continue to keep us posted on this, Jake Johnston, and thank you so very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And even as mainly young people, but also older people are out on the street, uprising going on, a lot of people are saying, you know what, these little band-aid solutions that they're offering, isn't going to cut it. We need, in order to get rid of racism in the United States and in the world, we need a total change of priorities, a total change of mindset, a total way in which the economic system isn't keeping down a particular group of people. And within that context, our sisters and brothers in other parts of the world are telling us, as you are out there protesting, don't forget about us. Don't forget the price that we pay with the U.S., your taxpayer dollars going to war and occupation and destabilization, as happened in Bolivia. We're going to take a quick station break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom land. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let no jailhouse turn me around. I'm gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching up to freedom.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website on sotrueradio.org. If you're on Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook, and our handle on Twitter and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. A lot going on in the world that we are covering, we intend to continue covering, but what I'd like to do is to give you a sample from the Pacifica Radio Archives collection. Let us go now to hear more from Malcolm X.
Back during slavery, when black people like me talked to the slaves, they didn't kill them. They'd send some old house Negro along behind him to undo what he said. You have to read the history of slavery to understand this. There were two kinds of Negroes. There was that old house Negro and the field Negro. And the house Negro always looked out for his master. When the field Negroes got too much out of line, he held them back in check. He put them back on the plantation. The house Negro could afford to do that because he lived better than the field Negro. He ate better, he dressed better, and he lived in a better house. He lived right up next to his master in the attic or the basement. He ate the same food his master ate and wore his same clothes. And he could talk just like his master. Good diction. And he loved his master more than his master loved himself. That's why he didn't want his master hurt. If the master got sick, he'd say, "What's the matter, boss? We sick?" He was as sick as the master. When the master's house caught a fire, he'd try and put the fire out. He didn't want his master's house burned. He never wanted his master's property threatened. And he was more defensive of it than the master was. That was the house Negro. But then you had some field Negroes who lived in huts, had nothing to lose. They wore the worst kind of clothes. They ate the worst food. And they caught hell. They felt the sting of the lash. They hated their master. Oh, yes, they did. If the master got sick, they prayed that the master died. If the master's house caught a fire, they prayed for a strong wind to come along. This was the difference between the two. And today you still have house Negroes and field Negroes. I'm a field Negro. If I can't live in the house as a human being, I'm praying for a wind to come along. If the master won't treat me right and he's sick, I'll tell the doctor to go in the other direction. But if all of us are going to live as human beings, as brothers, then I'm for a society of human beings that can practice brotherhood. So before I sit down, I want to thank you for listening to me. I hope I haven't put anybody on the spot. I'm not intending to try and stir you up and make you do something that you wouldn't have done anyway. I pray that God will bless you in everything that you do. I pray that you will grow intellectually so that you can understand the problems of the world and where you fit into in that world picture. And I pray that all the fear that has ever been in your heart will be taken out. And when you look at that man, if you know he's nothing but a coward, you won't fear him. If he wasn't a coward, he wouldn't gang up on you. He wouldn't need a sneak around you. This is how they function. They function in mobs. That's a coward. They put on a sheet so you won't know who they are. That's a coward. No. The time will come when that sheet will be ripped off. If the federal government doesn't take it off, we'll take it off.
So since I could see that America itself is a society where there is no brotherhood, and that this society is controlled primarily by racists and segregationists, and it is, who are in Washington, D.C., in positions of power, and from Washington, D.C., they exercise the same forms of brutal oppression against dark-skinned people in South and North Vietnam, or in the Congo, or in Cuba, or in any other place on this earth where they're trying to exploit and oppress. This is a society whose government doesn't hesitate to inflict the most brutal form of punishment and oppression upon dark-skinned people all over the world. To wit, right now, what's going on in around Saigon and Hanoi and in the Congo and in elsewhere. They are violent when their interests are at stake. But that, with all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be nonviolent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea, they're violent in Germany, they're violent in the South Pacific, they're violent in Cuba, they're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be nonviolent. That's a shame, because we get tricked into being nonviolent. And when somebody stands up and talks like I just did, they say, well, he's advocating violence. Isn't that what they say? Every time you pick up your newspaper, you hear where one of these things has written into it that I'm advocating violence. And I have never advocated any violence. I've only said that black people who are the victims of organized violence perpetrated upon us by the Klan, the Citizens Council, and many other forms, we should defend ourselves. And when I say that we should defend ourselves against the violence of others, they use their press skillfully to make the world think that I'm calling on violence, period. And I wouldn't call on anybody to be violent without a cause. But I think the black man in this country, above and beyond people all over the world, will be more justified when he stands up and starts to protect himself, no matter how many necks he has to break and heads he has to crack.
What I'd like to do now is, since really I started doing four shows a week since 2009, I think, we have been running our weekly Earth Minute and our weekly Earth Watch. We partner with the Global Justice Ecology Project. We want to keep doing that deep environmental work that is so critical. And with everything going on the street, protesters are now demanding, they want total change. They want to survive. We want to be able to breathe. And right now, not only with the police ignoring when people say, I can't breathe, and killing them, but we also have the pandemic of pollution that's also killing us and making it difficult for people like me to be able to breathe. Now, on Wednesday, June 3rd, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals issued an important ruling related to the use of chemicals in agriculture. The three-judge panel ruled that the Trump administration's Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, had substantially understated the risks related to the use of dicamba. Dicamba is a highly toxic herbicide that is used to kill weeds in a variety of agricultural areas, including food that we eat. It's produced and sold by multinational corporations like Bayer. You might remember Bayer and Monsanto. I think that evil company Monsanto, they have merged, and Corteva. The Pesticide Action Network, the National Family Farm Coalition, the Center for Food Safety, and the Center for Biological Diversity petitioned for EPA's negligence to be put on trial. And here to break all of this down for us, I'm really delighted to welcome Rob Fox, who is the communications associate in Iowa for the Pesticide Action Network. Rob is also a farmer operating a diversified vegetable and poultry farm in Northeast Iowa since 2005. Rob Fox, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Rob, tell us about the significance of this ruling, but also the implementation of it, because I saw an article that Nebraska, for example, even after this ruling, they are going to continue the use of this dangerous chemical. So tell us why that chemical is dangerous and the significance of this ruling.
I can certainly do that. Dicamba is particularly dangerous to us because of some of its specific characteristics. They use dicamba on multiple row crops, including corn and soybeans and cotton, but this particular issue has to do with what we call over-the-top sprays for crops like soybeans and cotton. You can apply the chemical before you put these seeds in the ground, or you can apply it after the plants have emerged. So what the case is about is it's about spraying the chemical after the crops have emerged. The problem with that is that the temperatures later in the season are much warmer, and the temperature difference between nighttime and daytime is much greater. And what that does is it does something called volatilization of the chemical. So you may have sprayed it on a calm day, and it may have gone to where you thought it was supposed to go, but when we get this temperature inversion, the chemicals will vaporize again and can lift up and move. And that movement can be many miles, potentially. And this can happen anywhere from 24 hours to up to 4 days after application. So if you have any of this temperature inversion, the chemical lifts up, moves, and drops itself somewhere else. And so that's part of what makes this so dangerous. It's not drift that occurs at the time of application necessarily. It's potential later drift. So you can't even identify necessarily where it came from, just somewhere within a couple mile radius. And then what it does, what the chemical does, is it is a growth inhibitor. So it doesn't always necessarily kill the plant right away. What it'll do is it'll cause the plant to have trouble at its growth points. You will find leaves that are curled. You will find leaves that cup, essentially causing the plant to have trouble maturing, setting fruit. It'll drop fruit. So essentially, you can lose a crop if you haven't planted the particular seeds that have been genetically engineered to be able to handle the dicamba product. So that's part of the danger, is that we're actually limiting the tools that farmers and growers have to do a good job growing, because we're finding farmers are starting to plant dicamba-ready seeds in defense, because they want to make sure that their crop doesn't get ruined by something the neighbor sprays and it potentially volatilizes and damages their crop. So it's a very, very dangerous chemical. It was known to be dangerous from the beginning, and I think this is where things get even more interesting. Monsanto themselves, in a recent Bader Farms settlement, did admit that they had expected to have farmer complaints about drift problems with this chemical all the way back in 2016. And they projected that there would be a couple thousand cases a year. And in fact, in 2017, there were 3,000 cases that were reported. So they predicted it pretty well. And there have been, since that time, millions of acres that have been affected by this. Many of those acres would be soybean crops that were not planted with dicamba-ready soybean seed. So that's true. But also the alternative crops growers, such as myself, are finding that we can't get certain crops like tomatoes or potatoes or squash. Those things don't grow, and you don't get a crop. But the plants don't necessarily die completely either, so you go through this cycle of hoping you can get them to grow through it, but then they don't produce. So there's a great deal of damage being done by this particular crop. And in 2017, the lawsuit that you mentioned was put into action. And in April, we finally had a finding that basically what it did is it said the registration for over-the-top application of dicamba for corn and or for soybeans and for cotton, that is to be revoked, so that now you cannot use it for those purposes. That's what the court case says. The EPA, however, has produced a document that is taking that direction, that is a little bit confusing because they haven't necessarily given very good direction on what to do about it. And they are also allowing everybody to continue to use stock until July 31st of this year. So their claim is that if you've already purchased the chemical, you have it on hand, it wouldn't be right to tell people you can't apply it, so go ahead and apply it until July 31st of this year. What they have done is they have limited purchase of new product for use this year. So that's kind of where the EPA stands. Prior to this announcement, each state was pretty much trying to figure out their own interpretation of what was going on. So in Iowa, they initially said, okay, well, we'll allow people to continue through this growing season to use the product. And with the EPA's new statement, Iowa hasn't changed their stance. So we will expect that as the soybeans get larger, there will be over-the-top spraying in Iowa for soybeans, and we will continue to have drift cases in this state for dicamba. In Nebraska, I believe the same thing. Uh-huh.
Your group, you are part of the petitioning for this ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that ruled that EPA's approval of that pesticide for use on genetically engineered crops was unlawful, blocking sales and the use of the three dicamba-based products, and that it wanted no delay in taking action. But as you've just said, there is delay. A question that I have, and others might have, the impact of this on the health of people. Now, a lot of us have trouble breathing, okay, just from pollution and which, you know, triggers these kinds of underlying conditions. And with the pandemic, a lot of these underlying conditions have come out. The people who are most vulnerable are people who have underlying conditions. And I'm just wondering, when you are spraying a dangerous chemical, when you have a dangerous chemical like that, how does it impact people? I mean, you know, the food, the air we breathe, And there is an interrelationship with this kind of thing, this kind of level of pollutants in the air and the pandemic. And I wondered if you had some thoughts about the impact on human beings of this and also animals, of course.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. Thank you so much. I'm an individual who works on a farm, and I also have asthma, so I have some breathing issues as well, so I can even speak to it from a personal standpoint. When there is chemical application being applied, especially when there's a little bit of a, you know, too much wind to be applied, or it's in the air, it can definitely cause breathing problems for a person like myself. In particular, when we hit the pesticide season, when they start spraying insecticides in late July and early August, there is a definite issue in states like Iowa where you can actually see a little bit of a haze that has nothing to do with pollution or anything else. It has to do with the chemicals that we're spraying on every acre we have in this state. So it's definitely not good for those of us who have breathing problems. But I think even the bigger part of this is the simple fact that we haven't done a particularly good job of studying how much of these chemicals are in our atmosphere. We haven't done a particularly good job of pinning down exactly how much this stuff travels either through our food system or through the air. And I don't think we fully recognize exactly how dangerous this tool is. And I call it a tool because that is how it is viewed here in Iowa as an agriculturalist. It is a tool. The problem is we've gotten to be over-reliant on this tool, and we've stopped treating it as a dangerous tool. And if you don't treat it as a dangerous tool, you don't treat it with respect, you don't do the things you need to do to make sure it goes where it's supposed to go if you're going to choose to use it. So in particular, that is, it's just a bad situation for us to be in. The other issue is the simple fact that we have stopped paying attention to one of the common tenets of being a good neighbor, and that's to not do anything that crosses the fence line, so to speak, and causes trouble for somebody else, whether that's you and I breathing, or whether that's my crop that is being damaged, or whether that is a stream that goes by and there are trout in the stream that are being affected by the chemicals. We're not particularly good at that right now. And I would like to see that changed.
Yeah, and you know, this administration claims to be farmer-friendly, but yet it was the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture from this administration that last week urged the EPA to figure out a way around this court ruling, and claiming that, well, we're getting a lot of phone calls and emails, you know, from farmers that want to continue to use this product, but also not acknowledging the scores of farmers growing crops other than dicamba tolerant soybeans and cotton who have suffered the kinds of crop losses that you're talking about. So we're short of time, so just a quick final thought from you, and also to let us know how people could get in touch with your organization.
Yeah, I'd like to start by just pointing out, if you wanted to learn more about the Pesticide Action Network in North America, the easiest way to do so is to go to panna.org. And if you would like to do things to support us, we do have an action page. View those actions and take the ones that seem fit to the things that move you. And we would love to have your participation. And then as far as dicamba is involved here, we have asked through the court for clarification with respect to EPA statement. We're hopeful that the court can then intervene and encourage a change in what the EPA has produced as far as the guidelines for this product. We realize that this is a small step because this is not even taking dicamba completely off the market. All it is doing is removing it for use for soybeans and for cotton.
Right.
But this would be a small step.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. Rob Fox, please continue to keep us posted on, this development and on the work generally that you're doing. We're very, very interested in having more of an urban and rural conversation on Sojourner Truth as well. We did a series on in Southern Illinois, and we're interested in continuing that. So we hope to talk with you again, Rob Fox. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Okay.
We are out of time. We want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project. We partner with them for our weekly Earth Minute and Earth Watch. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott, our audio engineer, Kiana Williams, our assistant producer, Romero Funes. If you'd like a copy of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and stay safe, y'all.
Sweetest of love, I listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? I look around and all I see, masked faces staring at me. Keep your distance, don't touch me. Get your hands off my teepee. Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity? I'm sick and tired of staying at home. Even worse, I live alone. Gotta get out, I need to roam. You can't shake hands on the phone. Touch, I need to feel, I need to hug a friend for real. I'm not down for this new deal. I'm not down for this new deal. The COVID killer keeps piling it on. Counting the dead goes on and on. We gotta stay safe, gotta be strong. Ride this out no matter how long. There's no borders, there's no walls. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Around the world, hear the call. Alone together, we stand, we fall. Somebody help me, set me free. I can't take this new reality. How much longer can it be? Where's the humanity? Somebody save my sanity. The COVID killer's coming after me. How much longer will it be? Where's the humanity? Thank you.
Today on Wings, women in Asia and Africa save lives during the pandemic.
There's a river of birds.